community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, a video has emerged of what appears to be British jihadists appealing to Western Muslims to join them. They say they're fighting for ISIS, the militant group which has taken over several towns and cities in Iraq. The video has not been independently verified. Adam Walker from the Ahmadiyya Muslim Youth Association has condemned the footage.
It does, I think, call a wider anxiety that this is happening, and it really calls on us to stand up and say that we won't have it, and that Islam is a religion of peace, and they should be loyal to their country, and they should respect the values which Britain promotes that are also promoted by Islam.
A woman and her husband have been found guilty of murdering her parents and burying them in her back garden. The bodies of Patricia and William Witcherly lay under their patio in Mansfield in Nottinghamshire for 15 years before being found last October. Police have promised to unrelentingly pursue all lines of inquiry as they continue to investigate the murder of a Saudi Arabian student who was stabbed 16 times. Nahid Al-Manir was attacked on a path in Colchester on Tuesday morning. A Tory MP's apologised for tweeting that he'd end up punching a journalist in the throat if he appeared on TV with her. Anna Jones reports.
Michael Fabricant said it about Yasmin Alibi Brown after she was on TV last night.
For an MP not to understand why that's wrong, he's not fit for the job.
He said sorry on Twitter, but not when we asked him in person.
First time I've ever been doorstepped. I feel like a star.
You'd like to just say sorry?
It sparked a mixed reaction in his constituency.
I think it's not worth punishing him.
Disciplined at least, if not like removed from his job.
David Cameron says the comments were completely unacceptable.
And in sport, England will be keeping a close eye on the Group D game just getting underway at the World Cup. Anything other than a win for Italy against Costa Rica will see Roy Hodgson's men knocked out of the tournament. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
Yes, it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to PCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is on his own this week, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. After the 6 o'clock news, more of everything Britain's mainstream media is keeping from you. What you don't know about can't hurt you, or can it? A year after the first Edward Snowden revelations, we hear from award-winning journalist Glenn Greenwald, persona non grata on much of Britain's government-approved media. Also, our NHS Foundation trusts are becoming more secretive and business-like as the NHS itself plunges into the red. The private healthcare industry are hovering like vultures over one of the greatest institutions Britain has ever produced. Yes, the NHS is now missing its cancer treatment targets for the first time ever. And you know what happens if you have to wait for cancer treatment? Yes, you're more likely to lose your life. Well, that's unless you can afford, of course, to go private. Daphne Havercroft's here from South West Whistleblowers Health Action Group, SHWAG for short, and she'll bring us up to date with what's been going on locally here and nationally at the NHS. Plus, it's Big Green Week. The government changes the law to make it impossible to stop Godzilla. I think it's called Godzilla, isn't it? And other fracking firms causing earthquakes as they drill under your house. They're also giving tax breaks for fracking firms. We ask, how green is that? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 21, a sunny weekend, although slightly cloudier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 21, sunny week, although some possible light showers at the start of the week. Next weekend, that's the 28th and the 29th of June, highs of 21 degrees Celsius and sunny. That was Bristol's sunny two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Martin Summers, Old Day Broxford economist. Hi, Martin. We're going to have a go at the news, just the pair of us this week. And I think we'll probably start by having a listen to something which came up at Prime Minister's Questions in Westminster. That is the European Union President. Just give us your whole take on how the EU operates, because this is an unelected position. Well, it's not elected by the people of Europe, it's elected by the people that we elect. And how effective do you think is that at actually making the European Union a democratic institution?
Well, the democratic nature or undemocratic nature of the EU is very much at stake in this. Up to now, the European Commission President has been appointed by the member states through consensus. So, in other words, the big boys, the Germans, the French, the British, get together and cook up who it's going to be amongst themselves. What has happened in the European election, the European Parliament election, is that they have made a bid to nominate the person who should be the head of the European Commission. So the European Christian Democrats, moderate conservatives, did the best, got the most votes across Europe. So their candidate, Juncker, has been put
forward. Well, let's just be clear about the terminology here. It's the head of the European Commission, so that's the chairman of this thing called the European Commission. These are also appointees. Everybody on the commission is appointed. They're not elected. And this is a person that they're talking about now, starting to use the terminology, this is the president of Europe.
Yes, but it isn't really. And of course, what Cameron is trying to do is say that we can't have a situation where the European Parliament chooses this person. And this puts Merkel in a very difficult position, the Chancellor of Germany, because she is basically part of the moderate right wing in the rest of Europe. Juncker is their candidate, and she is being put in a position where if she supports Juncker, she's falling out with Cameron, and she wants to try and keep Cameron on board.
But
Juncker has been trying to talk to Cameron, in fact. I was reading this morning that his people have been trying to phone to the British and say, can't we cut a deal with you? I think Cameron's been rather silly to dig himself into a ditch over this, because it's quite possible that Juncker will win in the end. He's got quite a lot of support across Europe. It's a fairly bureaucratic...
Whose decision is it finally, then?
It's ultimately the decision of the Council of Ministers, who will meet next week. In other words, the heads of the various governments. But the fact is that Juncker is the candidate with the most support.
So you're not going to see somebody like Nigel Farage or one of the Eurosceptics from around Europe? Even though possibly they are, because they are rising stars, aren't they, in the European Parliament?
Yes, but they haven't got, even in the European Parliament, they haven't got as many seats as the moderate Conservatives. And don't forget that the British Conservatives, when Cameron came to power, resigned from the moderate Conservative group and aligned themselves with the more extreme group, a much more xenophobic nationalist group. And therefore, people like Merkel and the moderate right wing in Europe are saying, well, hang on a minute, you resigned from our group. You're not in a position to tell us who we should and shouldn't have as the European Commissioner.
Okay.
So, there's potential conflict here.
Okay, let's go to Prime Minister's Questions, where a question was asked about this on Wednesday this week.
Ben Bradshaw, how is his campaign going to stop Mr. Juncker?
Well, it's a simple issue of principle. It's a simple issue of principle, much more connected to the principle than the name. And the principle is this, and I think it will be shared on every side of the House, that the members of the European Council, who are the elected prime ministers and the elected presidents under the treaties, we should choose who runs the European Commission. I don't mind how many people on the European Council disagree with me. I will fight this right to the very end. And what I would say to my colleagues on the European Council, many of whom have expressed interesting views about both this principle and this person, if you want reform in Europe, you've got to stand up for it. If you want a change in Europe, you've got to vote for it. That is the message that I will take, and that is the right message for our country.
Thank you.
just said there, I've got a message for the other members of the European Council, I will fight this to the end. So it shows that in actual fact he hasn't got the support of the European Council. The European Council do in fact decide, and they have decided to accept the European Parliament's recommendation, or that's how it seems to be shaping up. So Cameron is putting himself ultimately in a minority of one here. And that of course makes it very difficult for him then to argue that things are going to be all right when he tries to negotiate with Juncker, renegotiate the terms of Britain's membership of the EU. Of course, nobody else in Europe believes that Britain can renegotiate its terms. It's simply a fantasy of Cameron's.
The Green Party do, the Labour Party do. They seem to say, well, we want to be in Europe, but we want to renegotiate things. All of the main parties are saying
the fact of the matter is that what really needs to happen, in my view, from an economic point of view, if the Eurozone has to have a much tighter setup. And since we're not in the euro, we can't really influence that. And what we ought to say to the people in the euro is, right, you have a much tighter setup, we will take a back seat.
Isn't it simply a matter that Brussels is so far removed from most of what's going on the ground? They're in their little ivory tower. They have almost no connection with what's actually happening on the ground. They've lost the link that all politicians need to have with the people who are actually putting them in there in the first place.
The fact is that we still haven't developed European-wide politics. The European Central Bank, their policy determines economic policy across Europe. Not for us directly, because we're not in the euro. Now, ultimately, the eurozone has got to evolve into a properly democratically run structure without Britain, because Britain isn't in the euro. Now, what's actually happening now is that Britain is trying to block what the rest of Europe wants to do to try and reform the euro and make it work. And we're not in a position, because we chose not to be in the euro. Ultimately, we've really got not a lot to say about it. And ultimately, I think Cameron is being very silly by making a point of principle out of something which he's almost certain to lose. Because, of course, that doesn't look good, does it? It's like going to war over the Falklands and Argentina winning.
Whoops. So another local story now. Police Chief Nick Gargan is still waiting to be quizzed over claims. This is in the Bristol Post this week. Under fire, Chief Constable Nick Gargan has not been interviewed by the Independent Police Complaints Commission more than a month after he was suspended over claims of inappropriate advances, in inverted commas, towards women within his force. More than 40 officers and staff, Avon and Somerset Constabulary, have been interviewed, but the Chief Constable hasn't. The IPCC has revealed that two female members of staff have made complaints against him. However, at least one of them, whistleblowers, was complaining about his alleged behaviour towards other women, not themselves. And also, if he is found to have committed gross misconduct, it's likely he would lose his job. The Constabulary has set up a gold group to protect the officers and staff involved in the investigation with the support of Avon and Somerset Police Federation. Martin, this is a bit weird, isn't it? Suspended for a month, but the investigators haven't even spoken to him yet.
Well, I don't really know what should be happening in this. I presume that they're supposed to be getting on with it.
Well, a month ago, the Police and Crime Commissioner, Sue Mount-Stevens, said that, she has told the IPCC, let's get this sorted fast. It doesn't sound like they've even spoken to the Chief Constable yet.
Well, it needs to be sorted out quickly, because this has been a shambles from the get-go, hasn't it? The election of police commissioners turned out to be a farce. Sue Mount-Stevens is a perfectly acceptable person, but she only got 14% of the vote, something like that, of the electorate, and she's gone through two police chiefs in short order, which of course means that the people lower down can't get on with doing the job that the police are supposed to be doing.
Well, we've got these
the two police chiefs needed to go, but if they need to go, get them out and get somebody in there to get on with the job.
We've got these two allegations, apparently, against Nick Gargan of inappropriate behaviour, but he's out of his job for a month now without really having any kind of closure on this. Now, there's also another story in the Daily Mail, which was published on the 12th of June. A police chief in Sex Probe was hit by a new claim. An officer left the Diana inquiry under a cloud after a relationship with colleague's daughter. Well, it says under a cloud, that's in inverted commas, and those were comments by unattributed people who were involved in the Diana inquiry. Now, this is something I didn't know about our police chief constable, that he was over in Paris and he was one of the first people to be looking at what had happened over there. High-ranking diplomats are said to have been disappointed with the judgment of then-married detective who had, the detective Nick Gargan, as he was then, who had a key role into the probe in the car crash which killed Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed. His posting as police liaison officer at the Paris Embassy in 1998 came while he was on secondment to the National Criminal Intelligence Services. The job meant that he acted as an intermediary between Scotland Yard and the French detectives. According to a number of sources, his close relationship with a senior colleague's daughter was hushed up after returning home. Mr. Gargan, who's now 47, continued his rise through the ranks. Sue Mount Stevens, Police and Crime Commissioner for Avon and Somerset, said she was unaware of Mr. Gargan's unhappy spell in Paris when she appointed him chief constable last year, until a month ago when he was suspended over claims he sexually harassed four female officers and staff in Avon and Somerset. Mr. Gargan was being tipped as a potential future Scotland Yard commissioner. So it seems that this is potentially stopping Nick Gargan's rise to power. It'd be really nice if they could actually get this investigation done, but the IPCC do tend to sometimes take a very long time to do these investigations.
Well, since there's an investigation ongoing, I don't think it's that appropriate to comment on whether he is or is not guilty.
Well, we're not doing that. We're looking at the background to it, yeah, and some of the history of Nick Gargan, which has come out as a result of it. It's believed, the IPCC, which is investigating the harassment, will probe these Paris claims too, apparently. Mr. Gargan then, I don't know quite why, although it may, if there's any kind of relationship with what's going on today. Mr. Gargan, who then in his early 30s formed a close relationship with the daughter of a senior British embassy colleague. It's believed the woman, who was younger than Mr. Gargan, was working at the embassy at the time. She couldn't be reached for comment last night. This is when that article was originally written, on the 12th of June. It's understood British ambassador in France at the time, Sir Michael Jay, and other senior embassy officials were alerted to the relationship. And there's various anonymous sources quoted about him. But it's interesting, because Nick Gargan was due to be actually on this show last week, and then he was suspended. So it would have been interesting to talk to him about some of that Paris stuff. I've no idea why he was suspended, or whether this relationship, how inappropriate was it. If he's had a relationship with somebody else, that may have been appropriate, it may not. But anyway, so interesting stuff coming out about our Chief Constable, and it'd be interesting to hear from him at some point. His thoughts about the Diana death, because many people, including myself, are quite convinced that it was an assassination. It wasn't just an accident. Anyway, a watchdog attacks the government's handling of the fiasco of disability payouts. This is just over the last couple of days from The Guardian today. Outsourcing firm Atos has singled out for criticism after thousands of sick and disabled people suffered distress over their payments. Disabled activists have targeted Atos in recent years, with the company accused of letting down vulnerable people. The outsourcing firm ASOS is singled out for criticism in a report issued today by the Public Accounts Committee for misleading the Department of Work and Pensions about its capability when it was bidding for these £1 billion contracts. The report found many claims were delayed by more than 6 months, with claimants taken to hospital due to the stress of the process being unable to afford medically prescribed diets. PIPs are a benefit introduced to replace the disability living allowance, which ministers said was being abused by fraudulent claimants. Well, at the bottom of this, Martin, is the fact that there is a change to benefits. Many of the disabled people have been forced to make this change. They've been told they're going to get an assessment, and those assessments simply haven't happened. We've got hundreds of thousands of people who are waiting for these assessments, and in the meantime, they're not getting their benefits. They're not getting what they're entitled to.
Well, the whole idea behind this is essentially punitive. The fact of the matter is, I put the question this way round: what employers want to employ people who've got problems with their health, in terms of mental health perhaps, or physical health? So the idea that all of these, we've got 2.7 million able-bodied people out of work in Britain. What purpose does it serve to bully around people on disability benefits and suggest that they've all got to work? We've got to move away from this idea that work is the solution to our problems. In actual fact, that's wrong. And I think the Labour Party this week, going on about taking benefits away from 16 to 21-year-olds, are playing this silly game. Ultimately, we're going to have to redistribute work, and we're going to have to give people a citizen's income. In other words, pay people to do nothing, possibly. And that's actually part of the solution to the banking crisis, because we've got actually a crisis at the top, which has been turned completely artificially into a crisis at the bottom for some of the poorest and most vulnerable people in our community. And it's time to draw a line in the sand and say we're not having any more of this.
Isn't it part of the problem, in a way, that the Labour Party is still stuck in the past? It's calling itself, yep, the Labour Party, but we've lived through this amazing technological revolution where Labour is now almost superfluous. You've got machines doing most things.
Well, that's right. And ultimately, what they're doing is that the Ed Miliband this week, when he spoke about taking away benefits from young people, it's only young people who aren't in education or training and have got less than level 3, NVQ level 3. That means the poor kids, the ones that are coming out of care, the ones that actually haven't got any backup and support, they're going to have their benefits cut unless they get some kind of training organised. Although, where the training's going to come from has not been specifically pointed out. Everybody is beating up on the welfare recipients, on poor people on benefits, people coming out of care. This is not the way to solve the problem of the banking system being bankrupt. Those macroeconomic problems are what I expect clever chaps like Ed Miliband to be thinking about, not putting the boot into young teenagers coming out of care.
And disabled people. So indeed, what's going on here?
What's going on here is a narrative has been created of, we know what the problem is, it's all of these people who don't work. And of course, you've got plenty of people working who resent the idea that people are disabled and they don't work. They don't resent the bankers who've crashed the system and are in fact criminals. Most of the bankers should be in prison, their assets should be seized. That would solve the problem of the deficit. But of course, the Labour Party, of which I'm a member, doesn't want to frighten the horses. It doesn't want to be... this is very infuriating about the Labour Party. It's a big party, it's a mass party, but it's full of timidity, of inability to go for the jugular, and basically acceptance of the status quo. Ultimately, the status quo will collapse because the banking system will collapse, and then we won't be talking about disability benefits anymore. We'll be talking about putting bankers in prison. We're not there yet, but that's where we're going.
ATOS stated in its tender document that it had contractual agreements in place with a national network of 56 NHS hospitals, for example, 25 private hospitals and over 650 physiotherapy practices to provide these assessments. This turned out not to be true, Hodge said.
Can I just make a statement?
They got this contract, £1 billion contract, on the basis of lies.
Yes, and also, just let me make a fundamental point. Nobody but doctors should decide who is or is not ill and what their illness is. ATOS is a private sector company which gets paid for the more people it forces off disability benefit. And the people doing the forcing are not medically qualified people. It's absolutely ridiculous. In the past, it was doctors who decided who was entitled to whatever benefits they were entitled to. That was the NHS principle. Why bring in ATOS, who know nothing about medical conditions, to decide whether people are fit for work or not?
The effect on disabled people is actually really terrible and traumatic for many of them. I mean, we've seen this sort of thing in the past. We thought we'd had enough, and we got rid of all this targeting and attacking the disabled.
Well, indeed, and don't forget, as I pointed out earlier, 2.7 million abled people cannot find work. Now, that's not to say that disabled people can't. I'm just saying that let's not kid ourselves. What about the situation? And, of course, the other thing they're finding out is they're not saving any money at all. ATOS have walked away with the loot, and in actual fact, the government's ending up having to pay, because ultimately, you can't get a quart out of a pint pot. If people are not fit for work, they're not, whatever ATOS says, whatever the government says. Employers don't want to employ them. Now, you could have a government scheme that employed everybody, but then you'd have to raise taxes on the rich to pay for it, because where's the money going to come from for that? Unless private sector employers are going to employ these people. And, of course, they don't want to know. So what are we talking about here?
Okay.
It's just a nonsense.
On to another benefits-related story. This is the work programme. This is, again, The Guardian last weekend. Work programme is failing those most in need and should be broken up. Think tank says flagship scheme is acceptable for mainstream job seekers, but not for working with those with, for example, mental health issues. This is a £1.2 billion work programme. The government's flagship welfare-to-work scheme needs to be broken up in the face of figures showing that as little as 5% of unemployed people on the disability benefits are finding a job through it, a think tank is proposing this week. Proposals one of a series from the Institute for Public Policy Research in its Condition of Britain report, published on Thursday this week, including a proposal for a daddy month, 4 weeks paternity leave on the minimum wage, a plan that would cost the taxpayer £115 million. More than 400,000 working fathers a year could benefit from that. Again, Martin, this it looks like what this think tank's saying anyway is that this work programme has been a disaster.
Well, it's been a disaster for those who are disabled, but it's a disaster for the abled as well. Masses of money have been spent, and in actual fact, what they've discovered is the jobs ain't there, which is what the job centres could have told them in the first place. Now, the fact of the matter is that all of these attempts to socially engineer Britain, to try and make the social reality better, different, improve it, What we should have been doing, the people at the top, in the last 5 years, is dealing with the rampant criminality in the city and reorganising the economy so that we could all profit from whatever it produces. In actual fact, what we've done is we've been bailing out the rich and kicking the poor in the teeth. And ultimately, of course, at greater expense. Because, of course, a lot of this stuff is like communist China. They're just making it all up. Work programmes, ATOS. It's just like killing sparrows or something as a way of trying to solve social problems. And, of course, the bill is coming home for all of this. The deficit isn't going down as fast as we were told. The deficit was going to be got rid of in one parliament. No, it isn't going to be got rid of in one parliament. Do you remember that? And they also said that we weren't going to lose our credit rating. We lost our credit rating 2 years ago. Do people remember that? We lost our AAA credit rating because of this kind of incompetent nonsense. Waste of money. Universal credit. Another catastrophe. I mean, frankly, the people running this country are vicious, but they're also criminally incompetent. And in actual fact, you could argue if this was local government, they would be surcharged. In other words, they would all be bankrupted as a result. Ian Duncan Smith should have all of his assets taken off him to cover up for the mess he's made. That's what would happen if he was a local councillor. That's probably what should happen and what may happen after the crash, because there's going to be a crash.
On this work programme, Martin, the figures quite clearly show that actually the schemes that have been run and paid for by the government, these companies getting big bonuses for anybody that disappears off the figures, no matter how they happens, they're actually finding less work than the old government Department for Work and Pensions job advisors used to do.
Indeed. And those are the people who know the job. Now, the fact of the matter is that some people are going to get jobs because employers find them attractive and they think, yes, that's the sort of person we want to employ. And some people are not. And you can spend as much money as you like, and you could argue that most of it is wasted, because people who are going to get jobs are going to get them, and people who aren't going to get them aren't going to get them. And that, you could say, well, they should get a job, but maybe they're just not going to. And you can let them starve, or you could execute them, or you can face reality, which is that some people cannot work, certainly not full-time, and you just accept that, and you pay them to do what they do.
Well, it sounds for the time being they're just going to let them starve. Anyway, Rabbit Hutch Britain, growing health concerns as UK sets a record for the smallest properties in Europe. Jonathan Brown, this is in the Independent this week. Britain is in the grip of an invisible housing squeeze, with millions of people living in homes that are too small for them, according to new research, which reveals that more than half all dwellings are failing to meet minimum modern standards on size. The poorest households are being hit hardest, with estimates suggesting that 4/5 of those affected by the coalition's bedroom tax are already forced to contend with a shortage of space, Cambridge University study has found. The findings put pressure on the government, which announced it was to develop a national space standard, although this will only be enforced where it does not impinge on a development. Critics argue the UK already has the smallest properties in Europe following the end of national guidelines in 1980, but soaring land and property prices and shortage of new homes are fueling overcrowding, which causes health problems including depression, insomnia and asthma. So we're in a bizarre situation where, for example, a lot of the houses that are being built up in Filton are going to be really tiny, small. In fact, show homes often have sort of mini baby sofas and mirrors in them to make them look bigger.
Well, meanwhile, of course, at the top, many people have more than one home, 2, 3, 4 homes with many, many spare rooms in them.
Well, some of them are buying homes as properties to invest in, aren't they?
Indeed. Now, what you could do is you could change the tax system, and just as we've said to people in social housing, if you've got a room spare, we're going to cut your benefits. You could say that everybody who pays council tax on their property, if they've got spare rooms, then they pay more council tax. So, in other words, they've got to take in lodgers. And that would solve a lot of the housing problems straight away. Wealthy people forced to take in lodgers through the tax system. But if you can force it on the poor people, why can't it be forced on rich people? Just the same. We're all in this together, aren't we?
Just as an example, the average floor space for a dwelling in the UK as a whole is currently 85 square metres, whilst new builds average only 76 square metres. So that's 15% below the average. So if you're buying a new home, you're going to be buying one which is on average 15% smaller than the rest of the homes in the country. And it puts Britain at the bottom of the league table of 15 countries, including Ireland, Portugal and Italy. We're below even those three. The paper in the journal Building Research and Information said that the extent of the problem was not fully understood. Up to a third of householders were said to be unhappy with where they lived. I mean, it's a little bit right, a rabbit hutch mentality. It's lovely that they've called it Rabbit Hutch Britain, because, of course, when you squash people into this smaller space, it has actually a psychological effect, doesn't it?
Yes, let's call it Rat Trap Britain. Because that's what's going on, isn't it? Certain people at the bottom of the pile are having intense pressure created in their lives. It's totally unnecessary. It's not even bringing the deficit down. A lot of it is waste of money. They're setting up new organisations to waste money to bully people.
It seems what's going
on...
Nothing to do with
solving the deficit problem.
Is that the government that we've got, and probably it's fair to say this for New Labour too, in the past, what they're doing is they're looking at all the very basic essentials of life. That is to say, heating, water, housing, all the things which are guaranteed by the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, and they're trying basically to make those things cost more and more and more. So in order to have the very basics, you know, you're having to pay a lot. Once you get towards more luxury goods, luxury items, they are, it seems, bizarrely, are actually roughly level prices or even getting cheaper. So what's going on here is the opposite, really, to what I was growing up with in the 1970s and, not the 1980s, but certainly in the 1970s, where it was understood that all the basic essentials of life should be kept cheap for people, and that would help the country grow.
Yes, I mean, what we've got here is Robin Hood in reverse. In actual fact, the fundamental problem facing Britain is the financial services industry. That was blindingly obvious to people during the crash in 2008. The coalition have managed to steer everybody's thoughts in a completely different direction. We're now, everybody's an expert on so-called welfare benefits and all the rest of it, and we're trying to remake society so that everybody has to work, although in actual fact the jobs aren't there, etc. That's because people can't understand the difficult stuff about quantitative easing and banks and stuff. It's too complicated.
Well,
we'll talk about these people.
I hope
benefits.
Some of our listeners have got their heads around that, because quite a lot of it's like, for example, the takeover of Kraft, the attempted takeover of AstraZeneca. A lot of this money is just sort of magicked up out of nowhere to do these things, and it's almost like they're coming in like armies to take over these countries, although they're not using guns, they're using money.
Well, indeed, and of course in Ukraine they're using guns as well, because ultimately that's what it turns out. And in Iraq, that's what it turns into. You want their stuff, they don't want you to have it, you're going to have to fight them for it.
Okay, but before we do Iraq, a temporary road plan for the closed A431 at Kelston. Now, if anyone is backwards and forwards between here and Bath, they will be aware of all the extra traffic there is on the A4. Plans for a temporary toll road for traffic to bypass a closed route between Bristol and Bath have been drawn up by a local businessman. The A431 Kelston Road was shut in February after a landslip and will not be repaired until the end of the year. Now, I happen to know a little bit about this, because when this first happened, I thought, let's go and have a look at it. Now there's a crack in the road. Quite obvious that some work that was done, whatever it was a year ago, was not done properly. And I can't quite understand why the people who contracted to do that work haven't just been told by Bath North East Somerset Council, well, go back and do it properly. And in the meantime, it's not a disaster on the road. It's perfectly okay for bikes, motorcycles, cars to go along it, if they can keep big lorries, heavy traffic. And they could do single alternate line traffic lights or something to allow people through. Now, a little bit of tarmac or whatever put on the road where this little crack is. I mean, it's what, I suppose it's about an inch or 2 inches across at the biggest point. Well, you just make sure the cars aren't driving over that part of the road. And it seems like an absolute mountain been made out of this. And the entire road, it looks, is going to be closed for something like a year or whatever. Martin, I don't know if you've got anything to say about this, but it just seems of utter incompetence of Bath North East Somerset Council. And what this guy's come along and done is he say, look, I mean, for goodness sake, everyone needs to use this road. This is a important resource. You have to make a 10-mile detour if you can't use it. And so let's just be practical. Put a simple temporary road across the nearby fields and people can use that instead. But he's being told, no, you can't do that.
Well, obviously this is a very detailed question. The Liberal Democrat and Authority said it would delay a permanent repair and be vastly more expensive. So it could be that we're scrimping
because
we're trying to save money.
What they've said is, you can't have a temporary road across the nearby land because that will get in the way of the roadworks. Well, of course, it won't. This is just nonsense they're coming out with. Bath and North East Somerset leader Paul Crossley said it would not be a good idea. It would take too long to get the health and safety aspects of the signage worked out. They're doing an incredibly slow job. And I think, in a way, for me, this symbolises everything that's wrong with Britain today, in that you just seem to have people in authority who think absolutely nothing about the common person. The amount of inconvenience, the amount of extra fuel, the amount of extra time it's costing people to have to go around the 10-mile diversion is phenomenal, and yet no one really seems to care about it. Okay, well, I'll get off my hobby horse now.
Yeah, but the point is that everybody's claiming that there's not enough money to do these jobs. If you're going to do this job and do it properly. In Germany, for example, they probably build both bits. They just say, we're going to do it, because that's what we need to do. So local government and national government is pretending that there isn't enough money. There is enough
There's any political will anymore to look after the interests of ordinary people, the common man, the common woman.
It's not even looking after the economy either. Think of the economic effects to the wider economy of this road.
And some local entrepreneur comes up with a solution and then they just stick two fingers up at him. You know, really, we've got to do something about
it. Maybe, though, that it's going to cost more money, and therefore it comes back to a question.
He's saying he will do it, yeah? And he's come to arrangements with the local landowners to do a little detour. The idea of making a 10-year detour, a 10-mile detour, just seems ridiculous. Anyway, Martin, let's go on to some... actually, before we go on to the international stuff, let's have a listen to our local MP, Charlotte Leslie, and she was at Prime Minister's Questions this week, talking not about the Avonmouth flies, about volunteering up in Avonmouth. That's Conservative MP for Bristol North West, Charlotte Leslie. Also, wasn't she at once time the Big Society Czar? So maybe that's
she was
why she's...
Czarina for the Big Society.
Czarina, that's right, of course. Let's have a listen to her now.
I'm awaiting a detailed response from him about a dire pollution event in Avonmouth, my constituency. But will he welcome the happier news that just up the river, we're in the midst of a volunteering week of action renovating the historic Lamplighters Pub, closed under Enterprise Inns in 2009, but now reopening thanks to the determination of local residents and new owners Kathy and Dominic Gundry White? Will he welcome all the jobs, community spirit and real ale that that will bring?
I will delighted to welcome that real ale and, of course, recommend that they take advantage of the 1p cut, not just in this budget, but also in the previous budget. I know that people in Avonmouth have suffered unacceptably from this air pollution problem, and are very happy to discuss that with her. In terms of community pubs, I think we're seeing a growth in terms of community pubs, and I think that is all to the good. And it's welcome, of course, that we introduced the community right to bid. That has enabled a number of communities to take hold of these facilities and operate them for the use of the public.
Air pollution problem. Well, it was to do with flies, wasn't it? And I was chatting to some people down in Avonmouth the other day about this problem with flies. Have you come across this, Martin?
No, I haven't.
Absolute plague of flies. Well, it turns out it was due to the recycled waste that we collect around the city. Old food waste had been left on the docks somewhere in Bristol docks, and it was absolutely covered. It was going to be shipped out to some other country somewhere. I don't know quite where they were going to send it, but the whole of Avonmouth is absolutely plagued with flies. Anyway, they seem to have now done something about it. Mayor Ferguson's done something about it, but it seems like people like Bristol Port Authority, almost a law unto themselves, and this is what the locals were telling me, is that they can do what they want there. It's not really covered by normal things like planning law and normal British law.
No, and I think obviously what was clearly going on with Charlotte and the Prime Minister there was a bit of greasing, wasn't it, really? Would the Prime Minister like to congratulate us on all the wonderful things we're doing, and we've taken a penny off a pint of beer? Can I hear the cheering out there in the sticks? A penny off a pint of beer.
Yeah, so also there's this deal, wasn't there, to sell the freehold of Bristol Port, which George Ferguson has agreed to these port people who've then covered the area with flies. And also they gave a donation to Charlotte Leslie, which apparently is now being investigated to see whether it was appropriate, because she was asking questions in Parliament about the barrage, which the Port Authority did not support. So there were some questions about how appropriate that was. Anyway, on to some of the international stuff now. And Iran is hanging a billionaire over £2.6 billion bank fraud. Well, they still have the death penalty in Iran. It's the largest fraud case since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. It sent four scammers to the gallows. And this is the Associated Press, a billionaire businessman at the heart of a £2.6 billion state bank scam. The largest fraud case since the country's 1979 Islamic Revolution was executed last Saturday. State television in Iran reported authorities put Maha Farid Amir Kusavi, also known as Amir Mansour Arya, to death in Evin prison just north of the capital Tehran, the station reported. The report said the execution came after Iran's Supreme Court upheld his death sentence. His lawyer, Gholam Al-Rahi, was quoted by news website carabonline.ir as saying that his client was put to death without any notice. I had not been informed about the execution of my client. His business empire included more than 35 companies, from mineral water production to a football club and meat imports from Brazil. According to the Iranian media reports, the bank fraud charges began in 2007. A total of 39 defendants were convicted in the case. Four received death sentences, two got life sentences, and the rest received sentences of up to 25 years in prison, Martin.
Well, obviously, it's a very different setup in Iran than we've got here, where billionaire fraudsters get executed. I'm not sure I'm in favour of executing people, but the fact that they are caught and that they are seriously punished is perhaps a message for us. Although one has to question whether the guy's guilty or not, depends upon whether the court was itself genuinely independent. But nevertheless, you can see that it's a very different set. Can you imagine Rupert Murdoch being executed here for the Levinson nonsense?
Oh, right. You mean for all the criminal phone hacking, that sort of thing, yes, that was done under his watch? Mm. It's interesting, isn't it?
I think we ought to be able to imagine seeing him sent to prison.
At the very least. British public sector borrowing rises higher than expected, staying on economics. Economists say the government appears to be struggling to reduce the deficit in line with targets as borrowing hits £13.3 billion last month. That's May. That's just the Press Association and The Guardian today. Britain's public sector finances showed little sign of improvement in May, with economists saying the government appears to be struggling to meet its targets. Borrowing rose higher than expected to £13.3 billion for the month, against predictions of just over £9 billion. So that's quite a lot more than they were hoping. It's half as much again as they were hoping for. Samuel Toombs of Capital Economist Consultancy said the figures contain tentative signs that the coalition might be beginning to struggle to bring down the deficit in line with its fiscal plans. Martin, doesn't sound good.
Well, they've already had to extend bringing down the deficit. They were going to get rid of the deficit in one parliament, and of course they junked that quite a long time ago because they realised that they couldn't possibly be re-elected if they tried to do something like that.
Tax receipts weak, they're saying as well.
Yeah, well, that's. I think this whole recovery is like candy floss. And once we start to bite into it, it's just going to disappear.
I mean, without the stamp duty revenues from increased housing transactions, that's really been helped by the Help to Buy scheme. The figures would look dire indeed.
Yes, I mean, the fact is that what's happened is that they've stopped talking about the deficit now, apart from in a general sort of way, because what they're hoping is that the housing bubble will get them home and dry this time next year in the general election. So they do the... And, of course, this has a certain appeal to people, because you say, we've done the nasty stuff now, and it's all appeal from... It's all downhill from here on in, so just go out and spend.
OK.
And vote for us.
The national debt is... Would you like to hazard a guess without looking at the figure there?
No, I wouldn't.
Okay, it's 1.28 trillion. That's 76.1% of the GDP. Now, this is one of the things that would you like to just explain, Martin, why the debt to GDP ratio matters, because that is creeping up a couple of percent month by month.
Well, the debt itself is not the deficit. The deficit is the difference between expenditure and income in a single year. And getting the deficit down means simply that you're not running up any more debt. You've got to the point where you're not... In actual fact, we've been running up the debt by having a deficit since the crash. And, of course, we've all got used to this now, and we've got used to quantitative easing as well.
It's interesting how this terminology is used, isn't it? Because the deficit is just... If you're decreasing the deficit, you're not decreasing the debt. You're just decreasing the astronomical growth in the debt.
That's right.
And, that you're never going to be able to pay back, by the way. So we're now hovering around $1.3 trillion with the national debt. And that's 76% of gross domestic product, which is an increase... over April, when it was 75.7%. So, you know, it's still creeping up. That looks to me, the figures, as if the deficit's going up.
If they were actually reducing the deficit in terms of GDP, what would probably be happening is that the economy would be in recession. So, in other words, we've had a line of coke to get us through the election, and then we've got the crash to come. In fact, we may crash before the election. That's one of the things that nobody seems to be taking account of.
Chris Leslie, who's Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury, said borrowing is now expected to be just under £200 billion more than planned under this government. 200 billion more. That's quite... I mean, no, that's... You're talking about...
The reason that is because if they'd carried on with trying to cut the deficit in the terms that they were suggesting, then the economy wouldn't have started to grow. And then, of course, it would have possibly fallen off a cliff. So, in actual fact, what they've done is they've adopted what was Labour's policy all along, which is to let the deficit float up a bit in order to get the economy back into growth.
I mean, while we're talking about economies, Martin, can I just get some of your views on the on this business of banking deaths? Because particularly at JP Morgan, there's been lots of bankers supposedly committing suicide. And in other banking areas as well, in other parts of the world, it seems we've had a bit of a spate right from the beginning of this year, maybe the end of last year, beginning of this year, right through. I mean, is this? Do you think these people are, you know, are being dispatched by somebody, or is this just bankers under stress, bankers under pressure?
Well, obviously, it's very hard to say when you've got large numbers of different people dying in all sorts of different circumstances. But we do know for a fact that all sorts of criminality has been going on in the Forex markets, in the LIBOR market and so on. Now, some people know about that criminality, and therefore the fact that they fall off the skyscraper they work in and die first thing in the morning means that they will never be called to testify about what went on.
I mean, surely if there is any suspicion over a death, then there'll be some sort of proper investigation to find out if there was a motive for someone to kill them. I mean, well, for example, if they know inside information about a bank's criminality and they're considering talking to the police...
Yeah, but what you've got is that the police don't spend their time investigating this sort of thing. They basically they're told by whoever is dealing with it, oh, yes, they committed suicide or they fell out of a window, no suspicious circumstances, nothing to see here, officer. And the police, to their discredit, often just walk away on the other side of the road. Because even if they were to investigate, they'd probably find that it was virtually impossible to get to the bottom of it. That's why criminality at the top is tolerated, whereas people on benefits at the bottom who make an incorrect declaration on a form, they are to be stomped on.
OK, JP Morgan, 5 current workers and 2 former workers of JP Morgan, that's 7 altogether, have died under unusual circumstances. Adding to the tragedy, all 7 were in their late 20s or 30s. 3 of the deaths involved alleged falls from buildings, a rare form of death even during the height of the financial crisis in 2008. Why JP Morgan? Who are JP Morgan?
Well, JP Morgan have been at the heart of US financial capitalism for over 100 years. And, you know, I mean, all of these organisations are, in fact, bankrupt and are run by criminals. Let's not put too fine a point on it. That's absolutely clear. And the question is, when are we going to do something about it instead of beating ourselves up about people on benefits who are not working?
Martin, there's clearly, potentially anyway, a motive to murder these people. If they are in possession of knowledge which could bring criminal charges against, you know, the people organising crime within these banks.
Yes, yeah, so just imagine what it would be like in Iran if they were caught as well. They would go to the chair or be hung. You can see why they're determined not to be caught. But I think the level of criminality is absolutely clear in the financial services sector. It's endemic. And one solution to the crisis is simply to arrest all these people and seize their assets. That would solve the deficit and the debt in one go.
One good bit of news, new lease of life for the former ABC White Ladies Road cinema, that eyesore that's been up on White Ladies Road for probably 10 years, oh, it says 13 years actually, of lying derelict, as one of Bristol's last remaining traditional cinemas, former ABC picture houses, looks like anyway, it's at last, because we've heard this before, remember, going to get a new lease of life. Councillors yesterday gave their unanimous approval to reviving the 1920s building with a 3-screen cinema and 5 residential flats, so some good news there anyway. UK spooks can spy on social media and YouTube use. That's what the government submission argues. Anyway, this is in Computer World UK. UK's intelligence services this week can monitor citizens' social media, search engine and YouTube visits because these are external communications that don't require a specific warrant. The government's arguing in a legal submission which is made public by the campaign Privacy International. As it stands, the internet communication of a UK resident such as social media and email can only be intercepted in an intrusive way under Section 8 in brackets 1 of the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act 2000 using a warrant mentioning the person's name and address obtained from the Home or Foreign Secretaries. However, RIPPER also allows more indiscriminate self-authorised warrants in certain circumstances, which a detailed 48-page legal submission from the Office for Security and Counter-Terrorism Director General Charles Farr now reveals include communications deemed to be external to the UK. So what they're saying, Martin, is they don't need these warrants because it's external to the UK, even though, funnily enough, you're in the UK tapping and it's going across UK networks, possibly also obviously going abroad too. So the fact that part of the communication of the internet it may be abroad says that that this isn't covered by UK law, so they can intercept anything they want to.
Yes, I'll bet you a pound to a penny that they're intercepting personal emails as well. So when they're saying we should be allowed to look at Facebook because that's external, the fact of the matter is what Snowden seems to be telling us is that in actual fact they look at everything anyway. And of course the US looks at everything anyway, whether the British government does or doesn't. We all know the situation. I mean, in actual fact, the law is quite clear. They're supposed to get a warrant for all of this, but that was in the days of physical phone taps on physical lines. They've long ago stopped operating on that level.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, it was the anniversary of the first information that came from Edward Snowden. And over on Irish radio, there's a chap called... what was his name? Shuan O'Rourke. He interviewed Glenn Greenwald. So we're going to hear now an extract from that interview, which was on Irish RTE Radio 1 with Glenn Greenwald, who was the journalist that made many of these revelations about spying from Edward Snowden.
It all began with an unsigned email. I am a senior member of the intelligence community. What followed was the most spectacular intelligence brief ever known, brought about by one man who is now famous or infamous around the world, Edward Snowden. His identity was revealed this day, the 9th of June, 1 year ago. Journalist Glenn Greenwald was the recipient of that first email, and on Friday I spoke to him on the line from Brazil. I should mention we recorded the conversation before Vodafone released information about further government surveillance practices in 29 countries. I began by suggesting to Greenwald that this was a major scoop that he'd almost, in fact, let slip through his fingers.
Well, when Edward Snowden first contacted me, he was rather petrified, for reasons we all now all understand, of saying anything to me about who he was or what he had. All he wanted was to have me install very sophisticated forms of encryption technology, and at the time, I had no reason to prioritize him because I didn't know anything about him or what he had, and it sort of underscores how difficult journalism can be in a world in which the state is monitoring everyone who's talking to everybody else.
He wanted you to encrypt your computer, but why did he pick you in the first place?
He had been a reader of mine for quite some time, and I had been writing about the dangers of the NSA and surveillance for several years, and he wanted somebody who had an understanding of the issues, but more so was the media critique that I had long voiced, that the U.S. Media had become far too accommodating of the U.S. government, too close to and subservient to it, and he wanted to make sure that if he unraveled his life to bring these documents to a journalist, that journalist wasn't going to suppress the story at the request of the U.S. government, but would report on it very aggressively, and I think he thought that I would.
And you were eventually, I think, persuaded of his authenticity and value by a filmmaker, a documentarist, Laura Poitras. The two of you ended up in Hong Kong meeting Edward Snowden.
Well, from the beginning, when I began talking to him, he kept insisting that I come to Hong Kong, and that was the first really bizarre part of the story, which is, why would somebody who had access to huge numbers of very top secret U.S. government documents, why would that person be in Hong Kong of all places? And so before I would go to Hong Kong, I told him I needed to see some evidence that he actually was who he said he was, or at least had what he claimed he had, and he sent me probably 24 of the most shocking documents I've ever seen in my career from the NSA that made me get on a plane the next day and go to New York, and then the day after that to Hong Kong and to meet him.
Now, the two big stories that broke initially were called Verizon and Prism. Just, I know people will be familiar with them, but just to jog our memories, just take us through those briefly, if you would, Glenn.
The first story we did was based on an order from a secret American court called the FISA court that is designed to approve or reject requests by the NSA to surveil and monitor the communications of Americans. And it's a court that essentially is a rubber stamp in court. It meets in secret, so nobody had ever seen its rulings before. And we got one of its rulings, and that ruling was shocking because it said that that Verizon, one of the largest American telephone companies, is required to turn over every single day to the NSA all local and international calls from all American citizens. The list of who Americans are calling and who is calling them, it was limitless in scope. And then the second story was the PRISM story, which was a new NSA program whereby the NSA would gain direct access to the servers of the largest internet companies in the world, such as Facebook, Google, Yahoo, and Skype, so that they could directly obtain from those companies any communications of any people that they decided they wanted to surveil.
I suppose people concerned with national security would say, and in the National Security Agency would say, if we can acquire it, well, we should. And there's a famous four-star general you quote. I think his name was Keith Alexander. His policy was collect it all. And if the capacity was there, why wouldn't they?
Well, that's the debate, is do we actually think that it's a proper role of government to collect and store and monitor and analyze the communications of hundreds of millions of people or billions of people around the globe who are guilty of absolutely nothing? I mean, to describe that is to define what a surveillance state is. And there are countless examples throughout history, including the last century, where allowing a government to turn itself into a surveillance state is an incredibly dangerous thing to do. It's an almost impossible power not to abuse, and I think that's the debate that we're having.
And we'll come back to that in a little more in a few minutes, Glenn, but what about your relations and the way your dealings with Edward Snowden in Hong Kong? There was a lot of, I suppose, cloak and dagger, you would say, about it, because he wanted to protect his location, his identity initially, and you had to go through all sorts of hoops to preserve and to protect that.
He was, you know, petrified that the U.S. government or even the governments of Hong Kong or China would discover what it is that he had done, taken all of these documents, and would take action to prevent him from getting it to us and from getting the story out. And so he had worked for almost a decade inside the CIA and the NSA and had learned very advanced forms of spycraft, the sort of things that you really do see in spy movies, that he insisted that we follow in order to keep what we were doing completely secret, to prevent detection from government officials. And every minute that we were working, there was hovering in the air the very serious danger and a huge amount of tension that there would be a knock on the door at any moment or someone entering the room to put an end to the work that we were doing before we could get the story out. And that was what made what we were doing just so kind of tension-filled, was that concern, that danger.
And he had a particular concern, I suppose, understandable, that you had to take certain precautions with your phones.
When the first time that I spoke with Edward Snowden in person, when I went back to his hotel room in Hong Kong, the first question he asked me was whether I had my cell phone with me, and I told him I had a cell phone that was one that I used in Brazil, which is where I live, and he said, you need to take the battery out. And we looked, and we couldn't take the battery out, and he explained that the U.S. government had developed the capability to remotely activate people's phones and turn them into listening devices, to be able to overhear what people are saying by activating and turning on their phone, and that even turning your phone off isn't sufficient. You either have to take the battery out, or if some phones don't allow you to take the battery out, he asked us to put the telephone in his refrigerator, because sealing the telephone hermetically in the refrigerator would prevent anyone from hearing what was being said in the room. And so each time we gathered, we would put our phones in the refrigerator before we would talk.
Amazing precautions there, Martin, that had to be taken, apparently, with Glenn Greenwald over in Hong Kong chatting with Edward Snowden. But this is all quite practical stuff, and it is the big problem, of course, with the revelations of Snowden is also with this government submission this week, is that we are now all targets, surveillance targets, every single person. A massive surveillance state has been created without anyone really being asked.
Yes, and the US Constitution is actually quite explicit about this, written in the 1770s. It says that the state should not interfere with people's private communications at all unless there is a justifiable reason and a warrant issued by a judge on the basis that there's some felony going on.
Okay.
So in other words, it's against the Constitution.
Finally, on the surveillance stuff and publishing, Julian Assange is just spending 2 years in the this week in the Ecuadorian embassy. Got rather bad treatment from Channel 4 News. But what are your thoughts about him?
Well, this battle continues on every front, doesn't it? In the Ecuadorian embassy, in Hong Kong, elsewhere. And, of course, the Ecuadorians are helping Assange because they are very hostile to the United States, which has attempted to have military coups in Ecuador quite frequently in the past decades.
OK, well, that's now time for the Murdoch News at 6. More of everything after the news that Britain's mainstream media is keeping from you. What you don't know about can't hurt you, or can it?
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is...